toxic. Hydrothermal vents deep in the ocean, very hot, nevertheless provide an environment for some bacteria to thrive. Similarly, in very cold regions such as Antarctica, Professor Craig Carey is a microbial ecologist. He studied these bacteria in deep sea submersibles and on 22 visits to the Antarctic, along with other organisms. That sounded wrong. Studied these bacteria along with other organisms in deep sea submersibles and on 22 visits to the Antarctica. You understand my correction. He holds a joint position at the universities of Waikato and Delaware, and he's a director of the New Zealand Terrestrial Antarctic Research Centre. I spoke to him in Oregon, where he was visiting family, and he explained to me that for the first time, sampling planktonic communities underneath sea ice can be done year-round. What's the significance of the sea ice, I asked him.
I would say it's probably the primary and probably most important lifeblood for the marine ecosystem in Antarctica, certainly in the continental shelf area, is the sea ice. It's where the primary productivity concentrates, and therefore the food web concentrates underneath the sea ice, and everybody's eating everybody else underneath there, and it all feeds down through the food chain. And what we're interested in is up till now, there's been very little work that's been done that captures what happens outside of the time that we're normally in Antarctica. So we normally go down there in the summertime. So say from beginning of November to maybe the end of February is our full extent. And yet the sea ice and the importance of the sea ice continues year round. And so this robot that we're building will enable us to understand what's happening with the sea ice, the development in the springtime as the algae begins to seed into the sea ice and grow, and all the life starts to congregate around the sea ice. We're going to be able to sort of capture that with this robot. It's a really exciting project. The robot's smart, and it's able to sense the environment. So we can pull in a lot of the chemical factors that are changing, as well as capturing the biology and preserving the biology for 12 months. And and we can also control it from New Zealand. So we're going to be able to sit at our computers in New Zealand and basically see what the instrument is seeing on the seafloor.
But the difference will be to be able to see what's happening in the winter.
Yeah, the winter time is important, but I think that it's the early springtime when things start to start to change.
And that hasn't been possible before in early spring?
No, very little work has been done like this in any one location. I mean, certainly people have gone out to the ice and kind of captured stuff, one-off sampling, but not in the same spot. And on this case, because we can capture 150 samples in one load on the instrument, that we can capture it at a very high frequency and continuously. So it gives us this replicate sampling in the same location, so we can really understand what's happening in that location. And then the instrument can be moved to another location, which it will in 2 years' time.
We've been hearing about this microbial jungle under the Ross Ice Shelf in Antarctica, and, you know, new forms of organic life. Are they completely new?
No, I mean, in terms of the marine life that's underneath there, it's been well studied for 50 years, I would say. I mean, we kind of know who's there. What we don't know a lot about is how that community changes with time and how the composition might be affected by a changing environment. So there's a lot of things happening down there all simultaneously. We're just trying to get some baseline information on how the system is likely to respond to the predicted change for the area. I can't say that everything's new, certainly not, and maybe in that location. Some of the other locations I work on, it's new. But, you know, the marine system is a pretty ubiquitous and connected system. So I think that there's probably not that much new stuff, but the composition and the structure of those communities, that's very new for us.
I know you've said that we need to know more about what's going on down there in order to forecast the likely impact of climate change. But how does this help us to forecast? It's an observation, but it doesn't let you know what's going to happen, does it?
Yeah, see, that's, I think, one of our biggest problems has been that there's been very few long-term monitoring programs that have been put in place. And this is because of the, you know, the funding cycle for research is just not capable of supporting long-term monitoring. But the baselines, we don't have a lot of baselines. We don't know what's normal. And if you don't know what's normal, it's really difficult to project change or to understand what's going to happen under a changing environment. So there's a lot of emphasis now to start to develop and sustain long-term monitoring capabilities in Antarctica so we can better project what change is likely to do to the system. And it's likely to be quite dramatic. I mean, there could be some really major shifts in community structure down there that could affect everything from whales all the way up to the algae that grows on the bottom of the ice.
You mentioned that there are other locations in Antarctica where there are new types of organisms unknown before. And I'm guessing that you're referring to Mount Erebus, are you?
Yeah. Yeah, that's it's exact opposite of the marine system. Yeah, Mount Erebus has been one of my passions for about 12 years now. And because my background is in geothermal work, that's where I've done most of my research, on the bottom of the ocean all the way up to the top, and working on volcanoes and in Rotorua and around Lake Taupo. And it was a natural extension to go down to Mount Erebus because it's the southernmost isolated geothermal system on the planet. And we went down there with the full intention of that, well, if we're going to find new organisms down there, this would be a likely place to search for that. And certainly it has borne out to be true. We found some very unusual, very distantly related organisms down there on Mount Erebus. But probably one of the most interesting findings is we also found on the top of Mount Erebus organisms that are found in geothermal systems all around the planet. And so
that doesn't sound the way. I mean, oh, hello. We've got the same here as we have in Taupo. That's interesting, is it?
Yeah, no, it's well, when you think about it, we found things on the top of Mount Erebus that are very closely related to the bacteria that you find in many geothermal systems around the world. And when you think about it, it's actually kind of brought into question and that there may be a cosmopolitan community of bacteria that are up in the stratosphere that are injected into the stratosphere during violent volcanic eruptions around the planet. And that in that passage, they follow the conveyor belts of wind patterns and are naturally resistant to low temperature and desiccation and UV, and eventually come down in different areas. And if they find a nice hot spot to settle, you know, they're able to begin a life in a completely different system.
How can you tell whether that's the most likely thing that's happened, or that you've had some parallel evolutionary process whereby extremophiles tend to develop the same kind of characteristics because that's why they live in extreme places?
And that's part of the new project. I mean, this was a hypothesis that we've, and this is all based on genetic material that we've collected. And now we're doing a study in much greater depth to explore that exact question. And that's part of a Marsden project that's just started. But part of that same study was as we started to go deeper into the sediment up on the top of Mount Erebus, we found things seemed to get more novel. And that kind of discovery led us to apply for this new funding that where we're going to be drilling boreholes on the top of Mount Erebus and trying to isolate bacteria from deeper down into the subsurface of Mount Erebus, because we believe that's where some of the really unique guys are going to be hanging out. So that's whole new project is around sort of more subsurface biosphere as opposed to the surface biosphere that we saw before.
So how far down are you going?
Not very far. We're going about 6 meters. And the reason that we're not going deeper is that, one, is really difficult to drill on top of Mount Erebus, as you can imagine. But what we're going to be doing is we're going to be actually pulling out some rock from 6 meters down. We knock off the bacteria that are in the rock, and then we take those bacteria, and then we reseed those bacteria into a little growth chamber. We call it an I-chip. And that little growth chamber will then be put down back into the borehole and incubated in its own environment. The cool thing about Mount Erebus is that the geochemistry up there is very unique for a volcano. And so what we believe is that that unique geochemistry will be supporting and enriching for bacteria that may have novel metabolic pathways of ways of existing in the system that we haven't seen in other systems.
What's the point of the incubation?
Because we can do a lot of genetics on this. And this is the wonderful thing about microbial genetics. We can sequence genomes of these bacteria, and the genomes provide us with a smorgasbord of genes, and we can put those together, and we can get an understanding of what the organism might be capable of. But what we don't know, and this is why you need the living cell, is we don't know if they're actually doing that process. And so by having the organism cultured alongside its genetic, its genome, we can then test hypotheses on the of the metabolism of the organism against the living organism. So that's the loop of what is now, in terms of microbial genetics, is being able to identify a novel pathway, a novel way of living and surviving, then proving that it actually works. And that's what this whole project's about.
So when do you start drilling?
Well, we hope this year. Not that any of us are drillers, so it's been, I'm getting much better at drilling these days. I've learned a lot about drilling, and we've been testing our new gear in and around Rotorua, and we got some boreholes that we've drilled recently that have been very successful. And everything's ready, and we hope we're going to get up this year. Unfortunately, COVID has been a real thorn in our side.
Aren't people constantly drilling in Antarctica? That's all we seem to hear about, drilling in Antarctica for this and that. And, do we not know about drilling?
Yeah, that's true. They are drilling a lot in Antarctica. It seems to be the new thing to do. There's been a lot of ice core drilling in Antarctica for doing climate change work. There's been sediment drilling in marine systems, but nobody's drilled on the top of Mount Erebus before. And it has its own set of challenges. I mean, the fact is, you've got on an average day, on a really good day, it's minus 30 C up there. And so you're dealing with everything from wind and weather. And we did a shakedown season a couple of years ago for this project before COVID. This was 2019. And the guys were up there for 2 weeks, and they only got 1 day of science out of 2 weeks.
Wow.
And so it's a really hostile environment. But when it's nice up there, it is absolutely breathtaking. There's no place I'd rather be than sitting on that mountain.
The idea that something would end up living in these hostile environments is mind-boggling, isn't it? Like, why bother?
Well, you know, it's interesting because Erebus being geothermal, and it's been around for about 1.3 million years, Erebus has, is that you can think of it as a warm oasis. So when you have constant warmth, and when you think about it, the only place on the planet you're going to get that is in geothermal areas, and you have to have a pretty stable geothermal area, that you're going to get that warmth there all year round. And remember, in the wintertime, up on the summit, it will be minus 60 in the air temperature, but the ground temperature, if you put your finger into the ground, even though it's minus 60, you put your finger in the ground, it's 65 C. So what you've got is this beautiful, stable environment, and it's warm. And so things that like it warm are going to flourish there. And they're going to flourish there year-round unless they're photosynthetic. And so when you go up to these systems, you like on the top of Mount Erebus, you find moss, you find lichen, you find mites, you find all the soil organisms that you would find in other geothermal systems. And outside, even in your back garden, those types of organisms, if they're there, they'll thrive there. And it's been suggested that the geothermal systems in Antarctica were the oasis during the last ice age, when the whole continent was literally covered in ice, that these were the spots that held the diversity of the organisms prior to the ice age, and that post-ice age, this is where they sprang out of.
Little refuges.
Yeah, refugia. Yeah, they're
refugia. Refugia. Yeah. You call it refugia.
Yeah, yeah.
I know that when you work in hydrothermal vents, I think that you found the most heat-tolerant organism at that stage on Earth, something called the Pompeii worm, for obvious reasons, I suppose, at 80 degrees yeah. centigrade, which coexists with bacteria. So there are bacteria and this worm that lives at 80 degrees centigrade. Has that been topped, or is that still the uppermost limit of life?
I don't think it's been topped. The Pompeii worm is an absolutely amazing organism, and then that's why I spent the better part of 18 years studying it. It uses a number of different mechanisms to survive in that system. It's not one single one. And it uses a number of different systems in place. So it uses behavior. If it gets too hot, it jumps out of the tube. So they create a tube complex on the side of chimneys on the bottom of the seafloor. And these chimneys, and the water coming out can be on the order of 150, 160 degrees Celsius. And they create these tubes, and the tubes regulate the water temperature, and the worms live in the tubes. And the worms can, if it gets too hot, because it's a very dynamic system and a pulse of hot water comes out of the system, they jump out of the tubes. So that's behavior. The second one is that they have these bacteria on their back. They're coated in bacteria. And what we believe is like a firefighter. We use a blanket, a fire blanket. And if there's a blast, they'll cover themselves with the blanket. The blast of hot air will shoot across, and then they'll survive because they've got this barrier between them. And we think that the bacteria on the back of this worm help the worm to do that, because we can see them in easily 80-degree water with the hair kind of come. We call it hair. It's just bacteria, but it's they're quite long. They can be a centimeter long, covering the back, and the hot water flows over the back of the worm. And then the worm itself has inherent capabilities of surviving at that temperature. So all three of those things play into that record. It's not just one.
What's in it for the bacteria?
It's an incredible place for bacteria to hang out, actually, because the worm, most polychaete worms, will secrete a mucus, like an earthworm has a sliminess to it. And they secrete that mucus at these little spaces in between each one of the segments of the worm. And there's little glands there that secrete the mucus. And that mucus is full of carbon. It's a lush environment for bacteria to live in. And the bacteria that are associated with this worm, they are literally attached to those glands, and they create almost like the reason that they're structured is because the mucus surrounds the bacteria, and the bacteria are filamentous. They form little filaments and like little tiny filaments all bundled together, kind of like a dreadlock, actually. And so in the back,
like
a what? A dreadlock.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, just like I know it sounds funny, but that's exactly what it's like. It's a dreadlock with mucus and bacteria instead of hair, and they form this kind of tuft. They're riding on the back of the worm, and they're protected, totally protected, because no other organism on the vent system can get into that temperature where these worms are found. Even their most voracious predator is a crab. They can't get to them because it's too hot. The system is too hot for them. And so the crabs just sort of tiptoe around, but they can't get in and get them. So there's a lot of great benefits for the bacteria to be on the back of that worm.
So do the worms come away from the vent in order for the crabs to get them sometimes?
Yeah, that's a great question. Only when we, by accident, make it happen. So when we're collecting, the chimneys are quite fragile, and often we'll collect some worms, and a piece of the chimney will fall off. And it's almost instant. As soon as the cluster of tubes connected to a piece of chimney with some worms falls out of the manipulator of the submersible and it lands on the seafloor, and within a minute you've got crabs all over it.
I hope they've got other sources of nutrition, otherwise it's a long wait.
Oh, yeah, no, the crabs are, they're kind of the generalist in the vent system. They'll eat anything that they can get their hands on. You know, they'll eat bacteria off the rock, and they're well nourished.
Okay.
Because, I mean, in terms of an oasis, the vent is it in the deep ocean.
It's a kind of a chicken or egg question, I suppose. The Pompeii worm couldn't survive in those temperatures without the bacteria, and the bacteria couldn't survive without the Pompeii worm. So did they co-evolve or bump into each other by accident? Or what's your idea of that?
The bacteria are found in other places, not just on the back of the worm.
Right.
They're found on the crabs. There's a little crab called a Yeti crab, which is coated in bacteria like what we see on a Pompeii worm. We find the bacteria in free living in the system as well. They don't necessarily need the worm for that, although they like it on the back of the worm. The worm, there's another worm that's found down there that's closely related to this worm that doesn't have any bacteria on the back, which is really unusual because it has all the makings of that, which is the sliminess and everything. But for whatever reason, we haven't figured this out, the bacteria don't populate it. So I think they coexist because I think it's an ideal system for the worm and for the bacteria, but the bacteria can exist in other places. I mean, they really like the geochemistry in the system. There's a lot of hydrogen sulfide in the system, and they utilize that, and they're very capable of surviving in the system without the worm.
I'm talking to microbial ecologist Professor Craig Carey, who's worked in Antarctica and in the deep ocean in the hydrothermal vents. And I know you've been doing some work in the dry valleys in Antarctica as well. What's happening there?
Yeah, the dry valleys. In fact, it was the dry valleys that brought me to New Zealand. I mean, I was lucky to go out in 2001, that was my first trip to Antarctica, went into the dry valleys and realized that the tools that we were using, the genetic tools that we were using, had not been applied to Antarctic systems. And so I was sitting there with just this entire environment is wide open from a microbial genetic standpoint. And so I moved from the hottest place on Earth to the coldest. And the dry valleys offer an entirely, they're on the other end of the spectrum. The dry valleys are dry, cold, they're salty, and all of those conditions are probably the most extreme on the planet of that type. And so for me, it was a real logical move to move from one extreme environment to the other. And we started off from scratch, basically. We started characterizing microbial communities and really started to turn over a few pre-existing paradigms. And
such as?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, the paradigms were that everything was everywhere. I mean, we've actually found that that's not the case, that each of these valleys has its own distinct microbial community. And we also found that there's a far greater diversity in these systems than anybody ever thought prior to using genetic tools. And that's really important because from a standpoint of sort of new organisms and discovery of new organisms, cultivation has a tendency to really restrict your access to diversity. and the new genetic tools allow you to see that in its greatest light.
This is hugely expensive, this research, not only the hydrothermal vents, but Antarctica generally. A lot of money being spent on various scientific expeditions there. What do we gain out of it, other than, gosh, look how weird these things are living in this hostile environment?
This really sort of asks the question about basic science versus applied science. And I think that from the standpoint of discovery, basic science is incredibly question-driven. It's answering these questions that we start to piece the puzzle together of how these organisms exist, how they survive. And on the backbone of that basic knowledge is where the applied aspects come. So a good example of this is that we did a major effort in the dry valleys where we characterized microbial communities in all of the major dry valleys. It was one of the largest landscape scale studies in Antarctica ever performed. We had probably over 1,000 samples were taken and fully characterized. And what's coming out of that is that's the baseline information. That's our basic questions around diversity and biosecurity and issues around where things are and why they're there. That's what the study was about. But that baseline piece of information is now being used by researchers to go in and mine proteins and enzymes that have application in the biomedical arena. And who knows what, I mean, there's so many, once you've got the information, then anybody who has a need can then come into that basic information and see if they can find a solution. We have people doing that all the time now. Pharmaceutical companies have wanted to get into our database. We've got researchers from around the world who are working at taking what we've discovered and then applying it to their problems.
So do you stand to make a lot of money out of this? I mean, the mention of pharmaceutical companies, of course, you know, it sounds like you might have hit on a gold mine. How does that work?
Yeah, no, the answer to your question is no. I that's not why we do what we do. I think
not suggesting that's why you do it, but could you make a lot of money out of it?
I think a lot of money or some money could be made from it. I think you'll find that the community, this is, I'll say, the genetics community, is very willing in many cases to put all of their information into an open access capability. And we deposit all of our sequences into internationally recognized and internationally accessible databases. And other researchers can then go in and mine that data and find things that are of interest to them. And sometimes they involve us, and sometimes they'll contact us and are wanting to collaborate with us, and other times not. And I think we're okay with that. I think that's part of what basic science is about, is that we need basic science. I mean, it's critical that we don't stop filling the baseline data pools so that applied scientists can come along and have access to this information. I think it's critical.
Well, I'm glad you got to spend some time with your family. What are you going to do immediately after that?
I think we're going to be drilling another borehole in Topo, and we're going to be putting our first incubator chips down into the hole. We're planning to deploy the biosampler this season. And so that's a huge operation to get that major piece of equipment down to Antarctica, tested and in the water. Then I've got another project with my Korean colleagues where I'll be spending time in a penguin colony.
Oh, good grief, penguins now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I love penguins.
Who doesn't? Who doesn't love penguins? They do smell bad, though, don't they?
Yes, they do. Yeah. But you kind of get over that, actually, after a while.
What are you doing with the penguins?
You don't smell it anymore. We're working on developing some tools to look at their diets. I mean, this is all interrelated with the sea ice. And as you can imagine, a penguin every day, or one of the penguins in the pair every day, has to go out and fish and come back. And the sea ice tells them how far they have to go. The farther out the sea ice is, the farther they have to go. And so when wherever that sea ice, the edge of the sea ice is, where they're entering into the water, is determines what food they're going to find. And in different places in the in that range of the sea ice will open up different food. And different food means different diet. Different diet means different success on the chicks.
Excellent to talk to you. Yeah. And I hope you you get back here without incident.
Thanks, Kim. I really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Cheers now.
Cheers.
That was Professor Craig Carey, microbial ecologist. He's director of the International Centre for Terrestrial Antarctic Research at the University of Waikato.